Traditionally, presidents don't criticize the Fed. Then again, Donald Trump is not a traditional president. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, July 19th. Great to have you with us. And it is no secret that President Trump often does not follow the norms and customs set by previous administrations. And today, in an interview with CNBC, he did something that presidents almost never do. Criticized the Federal Reserve's interest rate policy.
I put a very good man in the Fed. I don't necessarily agree with it because he's raising interest rates. I'm not saying that I agree with it, and I don't necessarily agree with it. I must tell you, I don't. I'm not thrilled because, you know, we go up, and every time you go up, they want to raise rates again. And I don't really, I am not happy about it. But at the same time, I'm letting them do what they feel is best.
The Fed has already raised interest rates twice this year and is expected to raise rates two more times. Markets reacted to the comments, with the dollar and treasury yields both falling. Last Thursday, Kai spoke with Fed Chair Jerome Powell about political pressure and the White House.
We have a long tradition here of conducting policy in a particular way, and that way is independent of all political concerns. We do our work in a strictly non-political way based on detailed analysis, which we put on the record transparently, and we don't consider political consideration. We don't take political considerations into account.
You can hear the rest of that interview at marketplace.org. And we're going to stay with President Trump now, because today he signed an executive order creating the President's National Council for the American Worker. It's aimed at helping develop a high-skilled workforce. The strategy is heavy on pledges, committees, and advisory boards. And as for the money to fund it, that will have to come from employers. From WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris reports.
One after another, executives from Walmart, FedEx, Lockheed Martin, and a string of other companies pledged to be part of the effort to develop a stronger workforce. So did Johnny Taylor, director of the Society for Human Resource Management.
We, for the first time in a long time, have more jobs that need filled than we have Americans looking for employment.
Many of those jobs are in tech, but there were few specifics on how any of these companies plan to actually close the skills gap. Harry Holzer is an economist with the Brookings Institution. He says these training programs tend to be successful, but only when they provide broad skills.
If the employer is really providing the training and is portable, so if the worker changes jobs or changes industries within the next 5 years, do they carry much of that with them?
Anthony Carnevale runs the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. He says workforce trainings tend to pay off more in a tight labor market because jobs are there.
Training is not successful when the economy is down. It's successful when the economy is growing because the demand for workers and skills goes up.
And companies are more inclined to invest in their workers. The Trump administration has been very vocal about the need to create apprenticeships and training programs, but funding has been limited. Talia Milgrom Elcott runs the education group 100K and 10. She says the emphasis on tech training is great, but at the same time,
the real risk is that jobs that people can train for in a few weeks or months are on everyone's short list for jobs that AI is going to take in the next, call it, 3 to 6 years.
She says developing a strong workforce also includes building skills and critical thinking. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
In corporate news, Comcast bowed out of the fight to acquire Fox today. Instead, the company said, quote, "We will focus on our recommended offer for Sky." For those who've never heard of Sky, it's a European pay TV business that serves 23 million customers, mostly through satellite contracts. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains what Comcast wants.
There's a new term in the media landscape that Joel Espelin says all the cool kids are using. He's with the software merger and acquisition firm The Quorum Group. That term, full-stack video company. He says companies that are full-stack can answer these three questions.
What content can I control? What rights do I have? What studio resources do I have to make shows?
HBO, Amazon Prime, Hulu, and Netflix are answering those questions. They're delivering premium video content directly to the TV watcher. And they're doing it on a global scale. Right now, Comcast isn't. It owns NBC Universal, but
they don't have a brand that works internationally. They don't have an offering. They certainly have the ability to produce a lot of great content, but they don't have really any platform to ride, any horse to ride in that race. And I think Sky could be that horse.
Comcast generates less than 10% of its revenue from markets outside the U.S. Netflix, on the other hand, almost all of its growth is happening internationally. Jonathan Chaplin is an analyst at New Street Research.
Ultimately, what Comcast sees in this is the ability to establish this as a Europe-wide direct-to-consumer network, similar to what Netflix has built.
So if Comcast buys Sky, then Comcast will likely first push out its NBC Universal shows through Sky Networks in Europe. It could go the other way, too. Shows and movies produced in Europe might very well end up on American TV. Sky shareholders have until August 22nd to accept Comcast's offer. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, red across the board. Details when we do the numbers. Next, we're going to talk tariffs. First, it was steel and aluminum, then a whole slew of Chinese imports. Now the Trump administration is considering tariffs of up to 25% on imports of cars and auto parts. The Commerce Department let industry and members of the public comment on the proposal today. According to analysis by Politico, all but one of the 45 registered speakers opposed the idea. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
Tariffs are a type of protectionism, a way to shield domestic industries from foreign competition. Throw a tax on an imported good, that foreign good gets more expensive relative to a domestic one. So generally, when it comes to tariffs, it should be pretty easy to predict which companies will want them and which won't. But when it comes to auto tariffs, not so easy.
For the longest time, we just never waded into trade issues.
Jennifer Thomas is with the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, which represents both American and foreign automakers. Companies like Ford and GM, but also Toyota and BMW.
We just took trade off the table, and we just could not reach the consensus.
But this time is different. These days, the line between domestic and foreign auto companies, between who'd benefit and who'd be hurt by these tariffs, is much murkier.
All of our member companies are now global companies, so they are all impacted by these tariffs in some fashion.
And they do not want the Trump administration to impose these tariffs. They say it'd make cars more expensive for consumers, decrease sales, and put lots of jobs at risk. Emily Blanchard is a professor at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business.
There are no major national car companies that are just American or just German or just Japanese.
She says even within one company, tariffs could affect different models in different ways.
For example, if you want to buy a Subaru Outback, there's a really good chance that your Outback was made in the United States. I think it's, 80%+ of the Outbacks are made in the U.S. But if you buy a Forester right next to it on the lot, that Forester was made in Japan.
The Trump administration is also considering whether these tariffs should apply to car parts as well. Christian Gicek is with the Center for Automotive Research.
There's a lot of Canadian and Mexican content in domestically built vehicles, and there's a lot of U.S. content in vehicles built in Canada and Mexico. The auto supply chains within NAFTA are so integrated.
Like with steel and aluminum tariffs, the question the Trump administration is considering is whether auto imports are a threat to U.S. national security. In announcing its investigation, the Commerce Department said it was because the domestic auto industry has long been seen as an important source of American technological innovation. So it wants to know if imports are weakening the industry, weakening the overall economy, and therefore compromising national security. But more tariffs will surely prompt more retaliation, says Dartmouth's Emily Blanchard.
If the U.S. puts on substantial auto tariffs, this is yet another policy grenade going off in the trade policy landscape. And I would be very surprised if this didn't substantially and rapidly escalate the trade war.
Many allies and trading partners are already smarting from the billions of dollars of tariffs the Trump administration has previously put in place. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We're going to zero in on what's known as Section 232 tariffs. Those are the ones on steel and aluminum, and they're named for a section of a law from the 1960s. A company can file for an exemption or exclusion from them if the product they need isn't made anywhere in the U.S. Todd Adams is vice president of Stainless Imports. It's a family-owned manufacturer in Florida. We had Adams on the show back in May. The Commerce Department just denied his exemption request, and we gave him a call in his office. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back again.
Well, why don't you tell me what exactly you were applying for this exemption for? It's a very specific part, right?
Yes, it's essentially stainless steel tubing that's utilized in the food and beverage, particularly dairy production industry. But this tubing was it was the sizing that made it unique. We checked. No one can make it in the United States, including ourselves. And I was able to find one mill that could do it. They happened to be in China. And we got the order, a very large order for my company. It was over $1 million. Our standard order is maybe $20,000.
Wow.
So this was 10 containers worth of material. Nine containers. The first two came in, you know, before the duties were announced. And as all the other containers were already on the water, the executive branch announced these 232 tariffs effective in 15 days. That's shorter than the transit time from China to the United States. So, you know, you can't turn the boat around. So we had to pay several hundred thousand dollars in duties to get our material out of customs. We did it knowing that there would be an exemption process. I put my faith in the United States government and said, I'm 100% sure we'll be getting our money back. Turns out it wasn't so clear cut.
Well, why did they deny your application? What did they say?
They said the tariff code is wrong. And it may be wrong. I mean, I'm not a tariff expert, but I can tell you that all nine containers were imported and accepted by U.S. Customs into the United States under the tariff code I indicated. So only now they're saying, wait a second, you should have used another tariff code. So it's literally a technicality.
Do you consider yourself a political person, or are you kind of surprised that you ended up in this position?
Yeah, I'm not a political person at all. I'm very surprised. I never thought I would be involved in this, and I didn't ask to get involved in this, but I've been pulled into it. It's very personal. You know, they basically have robbed me of, you know, my life savings, and it's just not fair. It amounts to theft. And the fact that they're denying my application based on a technicality that they have invented is it really just adds insult to injury.
The idea behind these tariffs in some ways was to boost U.S. companies like yours. What would you say to the president if you could?
It's, you know, I understand the concerns that we have regarding trade. I understand that China has acted in some ways that are certainly not ethical, not fair, but these tariffs, in particular, the way these 232 tariffs were implemented, the timeline that they were implemented, and this exemption process is utterly flawed, and it's hurting a lot of businesses.
Todd Adams, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Adams has been in touch with the Commerce Department. Yesterday, they walked him through his options for redoing his application, and he's planning to testify to Congress next week. Coming up,
sunshine and girls in bikinis and pools and beaches and vacations and road trips out west.
How music sells you summer. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 134 points, 0.5%, to close at 25,064. The NASDAQ slipped 29 points, 0.3%, to finish at 7,825. And the S&P 500 sagged 11 points, 0.4%, to end at 2,804. As we reported, Comcast dropped its bid for 21st Century Fox's movie studio and TV assets. Comcast clicked up 2.5%. Fox was pretty much unchanged. All this was seen as a win for Disney, which gained 1.3%. 10% because it's also interested in those Fox assets. We looked at the possibility of tariffs on cars and auto parts. Ford Motor sputtered 0.4%, GM slowed down 1.4%, and Fiat Chrysler sped up 1.3%. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.83%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. The phrase extreme weather might make you think of hurricanes or tornadoes, but there is a more subtle form of severe weather that can also be deadly: heat waves. And they're even more dangerous if you live in dense urban areas. They're sometimes called urban heat islands. Justine Kalma wrote about them for the website Grist. First, I asked her to define an urban heat island.
Okay, so cities tend to be several degrees warmer than their neighbors, and this is because of several things. One, black pavement, dark rooftops, they trap and absorb heat. Because of that pavement and large buildings, you tend to have fewer trees and less green space in cities. And so cities, especially at night, can reach up to 22 degrees warmer than their rural counterparts.
Wow.
Yeah.
In reporting this story, you spent some time in a neighborhood in the South Bronx called Hunts Point.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah. So within an urban heat island, you're going to have what they call micro urban heat islands or hot spots. So places in the city that are even hotter than the rest of New York City, for example, when it comes to Hunts Point. It's home to the largest wholesale produce market in the entire world. So the rest of the city really depends on this neighborhood to bring in their food. And I'm not talking about your friendly neighborhood farmers market. This is an industrial area. If you look at it, it looks like a bunch of warehouses.
Yep.
Obviously, there's going to be a lot of truck traffic coming in and out. And so Hunts Point has traditionally been thought of as this industrial zone, but there are more than 13,000 residents there, and 98% of them are folks of color.
When we think about how to combat urban heat islands and what happens to people, so whether it's heat exhaustion, heat stroke, et cetera, how do cities do that, both in the short term and the long term?
So one is to change the way the city looks, to change the sort of historic disinvestment in these black and brown communities by investing instead in more trees, more green space. The city is doing things like planting green rooftops because vegetation helps to cool down cities through moisture, and trees also provide shade. So there are those sort of structural changes. And then on the other end is actually tackling the public health and environmental inequity threats. So on average, New York City sees more than 100 heat-related deaths every year. And between 2000 and 2012, half of those were African Americans.
And that's disproportionate when you look at the share of African Americans who live in New York.
Oh, totally.
Somewhere around less than 25%.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
We are talking about New York City and the U.S., but this is a widespread issue. So when we talk about global heat islands, where have we seen the impact recently?
This summer, the heat has just been really deadly. In Tokyo on Wednesday, there were 317 people taken to a hospital, and the city responded to 3,000 emergency calls as a result of the heat. You also had earlier this month in Montreal, there were 53 people at least who died in relation to a heat wave that they experienced as well. So this is a really huge issue. We're seeing it in New York, and New York is seen as a leader in taking action on it. But that's going to have to be a model, because we need to be dealing with this across the U.S. and globally as well, especially as temperatures rise as a result of climate change. This is only going to get worse.
Justine Kalma, who's a staff writer for Grist, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now for the latest installment of what we call Summer, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
It's a seasonal series about the people and products that make summer what it is in America. Today, we've got the origin story behind a long-standing summer tradition, that tune you can't get out of your head, the Song of the Summer. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra reports.
In the spring of 2017, DJ Khaled released a song called I'm the One. Maybe you've heard it. It was everywhere. We the best music. Another one. DJ Khaled. Yeah, you're looking at the truth, the money never lie, no. The song featured Justin Bieber, Quavo, Chance the Rapper, and Lil Wayne. In the music video, they're at a mansion hanging by the pool. Bieber's in a bathing suit. Women are dancing around in bikinis. The champagne's flowing. The grill's fired up. It's your typical summer outing. Charlie Foster remembers when he first heard this song. He's a promotions executive at Epic Records, which distributes DJ Khaled's music.
We thought, here we go. We got it. We were going to have the song of the summer.
The song of the summer. You know, the one you can't get away from. It's blaring from car speakers at the beach. It's inescapable on the radio. It's a record label's dream.
You're getting sales, you're getting streams, you're getting potentially lots of TV exposure. That's the biggest song on the planet.
So just how big did I'm the One get last summer? I'll come back to that. But first, we're going to consider something else. Where did this idea of the song of the summer even come from? To answer that, let's head to a one-block stretch of West 28th Street in New York City. It's lined with flower shops and stores selling cheap t-shirts and bedazzled baseball caps. This neighborhood was once known as Tin Pan Alley. And you could argue that this is where the song of the summer was born. David Freeland is a music historian.
This is the place where the music industry as a business coalesced.
It was the late 1800s, the era of sheet music. Walking the streets, you could hear composers playing their songs on cheap pianos through open windows. They wrote catchy tunes that fit into categories.
One was the sentimental ballad. Those were always popular. Another was the patriotic song. And also, there was the summer song.
By the early 1900s, newspapers were writing about the latest summer hits, like this one from 1905.
In the shade of the old apple tree.
Soon, the papers were crowning the song of the summer, the one hit everybody seemed to be singing that year. Now fast forward to the early 60s in sunny Los Angeles.
If everybody had a move across the USA.
Film studios cranked out beach movies. Surf music was in its heyday. Jen Gunderman teaches musicology at Vanderbilt University.
Pop music started being associated with sunshine and girls in bikinis and you know, pools and beaches and vacations and road trips out west.
From then on, these images became commonplace in songs of the summer. But at some point, the song of the summer changed. It didn't have to be about summer anymore. It just had to be really popular during the summer. And it had to swing.
Maybe that's the one thing they really all have in common, is that you have to be able to wiggle when you're listening to it. It has to be something that is energizing.
Now, naming a song of the summer, that can be pretty subjective. Billboard defines it as the most popular song on its Hot 100 chart from Memorial Day to Labor Day. So, did DJ Khaled's song, I'm the One, win the title last year? Let's go back to Charlie Foster from Epic Records.
Nope. Came close, but no.
The reigning champion of summer 2017 was a little song called
Despacito. Quiero respirar tu cuello despacito.
Hands down, that was the song of the century.
As for the song of summer 2018, maybe it'll be Drake's Nice for What, or Girls Like You by Maroon 5, or Cardi B's I Like It. My money is on Cardi B. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
This final note before we go today, here's the story of a house you can buy.
See what I did there? If you have $1.88 million and want to live in the Brady Bunch house in Los Angeles, we're talking about the house where the show's exteriors were shot. According to the LA Times, the indoor scenes were shot on a set. The house is a wood and stone split level, and if you watched the show, you saw it in the opening and closing sequences. The LA Times says the owners don't want someone to buy it just to tear it down and build on the lot, and they're hoping that there are buyers out there who want to preserve it. All right, that's it. We got to go. The Dow Jones lost 134 points today, 0.5%. The NASDAQ slipped 29 points, 0.33%. And the S&P 500 dipped 11 points, 0.4%. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. And I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you all tomorrow, everyone. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.